Well, I'm going to call this meeting to order. Invocation, Mr. Ross, would you do us the honor, please?
At this council meeting, help us to make decisions which keep us faithful to our mission and reflect our values. Give us the strength to hold to our purpose, wisdom to guide us, and a keen perception to lead us. And above all, keep us charitable as we deliberate.
Thank you. Robert, would you lead us? Thank you. All right, public comment, any public comment cards? Mr. Robinson.
Bill Robinson, 4731 Holly Oak Place, Dunwoody. I will make my comments very brief. As you all know, I was chair of two committees that produced the document we're going to study tonight. I was chair of the Sound Ordinance Committee and of the Dunwoody Village Overlay District Ordinance. We provided input. With your indulgence, I would prefer to comment specifically as we go through the document, and when we get to that page, then if I can raise my hand and y'all would be so kind, and I'll talk, but I'll try to keep quiet otherwise. But what I wanted to talk about is how we got here. The sign ordinance is coming through finally for its first overhaul. Now, if you recall, the sign ordinance, and in that case, the overlay district ordinance, were two that were adopted immediately because of the scare over the billboards. We went ahead and did the overlay district ordinance, except for the sign portion, and we didn't touch it. So we have a new overlay district ordinance, but we are, for the first time, modifying the sign ordinance. And I had different committees for both, but when we redid the overlay district sign portion of that, the sign committee did that. Also, I would remind you that it's in the works for the PCID to have an overlay district. It's not in progress yet. It will be. It would have been improper for try to do it simultaneously. One, they're not ready with the documentation. It's much more complex for them. And two, when it goes through, check this with Mr. Anderson, and that we're going to have to make a modification of the code so you can relax as well as constrict with an overlay district. Once we do that, then we can make things in the PCID a bit less restrictive. The reason I say that tonight is that we don't need to necessarily relax the sign ordinance for the city to accommodate all of the PCID. Let's do that when we do their overlay district. And there's two outs for them in the meantime. One, everything they've got is grandfathered, so it's not going to change unless they make a radical change. And two, they can make changes to the face of any sign, regardless of that. So, being what it is, I would hope we would look at the sign ordinance for the city in toto and strike some balance between the perimeter center and maybe the overlay district in Dunwoody Village. I would also tell you that everything, not everything, but most of the things we looked at when we did the sign ordinance and the overlay district, it's a balance between what some people would want versus what others would want. I would use a couple of phrases, and I don't mean these in jest. My mother used to say the worst thing you could do for anybody or say about anybody is call it tacky. Well, I'll take another quote. It's all in the eyes of the beholder, and that's the problem. What you call tacky and what I call tacky for the same item may be different. And so the problem with doing signed ordinances or any other ordinance, for that matter, is trying to find that balance between tacky in your eyes and tacky in my eyes.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. That was the last public comment card. And I didn't do a roll call. Let me rewind a couple steps here. Everybody is in attendance except for Councilwoman Bonzer, Councilman Hennigan, and Councilman Taylor. All right, with that, if there are no objections, I'm going to flip-flop 1 and 2 on items F. So 1 and 3, I'm sorry. What would I do if I didn't have my trusty sidekick? All right, 1 and 3 are flip-flop, and before we do that, I will go to any council comment, Robert? Rock and roll. All right. Approval of intergovernmental agreement with MARTA to use MARTA ARC offset funds for the Dumbly Village Parkway project. Michael.
Good evening.
Hello.
The agreement before you is an instrument for us to be able to accept reimbursement for the MARTA offset funds that are allocated, were allocated through ARC. There's $275,000 available for the project. The way the document's been drafted, and we've discussed this with MARTA, that funding can be used for design, right-of-way, or construction. Our recommendation is to go ahead and, even though the city has budgeted for the design, to go ahead and use as much of the money as we spend it and save the money we've allocated for design and put that towards construction. So we recommend approval of this agreement, and then we'll forward it on to MARTA for their approval.
Okay, questions?
Hey, no questions. I'm going to throw that.
Well, I'll say that,
what total funding? There's another $800,000 figure somewhere out there.
The last page, Exhibit B1, page 7, gives a breakdown of the funding. There's $275,000 from MARTA. This is for the total project.
Okay.
We've put in $225,000 for the city. $200,000 of that has already been budgeted. And then there's $500,000 in construction, this specifically for construction through DOT, the Transportation Enhancement Grant.
Thanks, Michael. I should have seen it, but I've been reading sign arguments all day.
Okay. Any other questions? Motion from Councilman Ross for approval. I'll second. Any discussion on that? See that there's none. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Approval of the MARTA ARC offset. Now we'll jump back to the public hearing. If there are no objections, I'm going to open this public hearing. All right, public hearing is open. Howard.
Good evening. As Bill mentioned in his opening remarks, this document in front of you is the culmination of a long period of work. It was unfortunately delayed a while during some legal issues, but that resolved itself, and it started again. The first draft of the revision of Chapter 21, which is the sign code in the city ordinance, was done by the sign committee. Those changes were put together and reviewed again. After that, staff, including myself and Rebecca and Mike Tuller, looked at the document, and we made our recommendations. Following that, we had Laurel Henderson, who's our attorney, the city's attorney, review the document for its whether or not it was legal or not. And she weighed in at a third set of comments and revisions. Those three sets of comments were transmitted simultaneously to the community council. And the community council read the document, made some minor tweaks, but overall were in favor of the changes that we made. So those were put together and then sent for a fifth review to the planning commission, who made their recommended changes. And all of that is represented in the document that's before you this evening. Staff's recommendation is that if you make changes, that you make the changes in a manner consistent with the document that's in front of you. There are two significant points that staff would like to point out. One of which is the idea of the pole banners. Pole banners are now labeled as Section 20 near the end of the Chapter 21 document. And staff has some reservations about this because what it is signs in the right-of-way. And that is just a tenant, just a planning no-no. However, we're going to go ahead and try it. I know that there's some history in this region of using them, and I don't believe there will be such a backlash of negative unintended consequences that it will be a problem. And if it is, we can always come back and do another text amendment and remove them from the right-of-way. But I think that they can be administered judiciously. I think that it can be done tastefully. And I know that there is some support in the community for what they achieve. So if administered properly, they can be done well. So we've decided that we're willing to give it a chance. The second significant item is actually in Chapter 27. It's in the overlay district. There was a recommendation, 3C13, what is now D, would have exempted one or two tenants in the same building having a ground sign that would essentially have exposed poles. That would be a relaxation of the sign code, and it's been my understanding that since being a planner in Georgia, that overlay districts cannot relax a standard. They can only be more stringent than another standard. And if you'll notice, everything else in the overlay district, every other one of the guidelines, is more stringent than what we have for the rest of the city. So staff wouldn't recommend that you allow pole signs.
Yeah, Robert, I'm going to reference where that is.
Yeah, it's my document, it's the penultimate page. It's the next to last page. Section 3, C as in Charlie, -13, at Chapter 27. And if you'll look at the what's labeled as underscore D, the parenthetical underscore D, and right now it's struck through.
Yes.
Because staff's recommendation is that you not allow that. But that parenthetical D was actually a product that was developed by the sign committee, and they wanted to see that inserted. So if you go to the next to the last page.
Page 1 of Chapter 27.
Yeah, right. That's right. And it reads ground signs for one or two tenants in the same building. Well, it reads may shall be. Either monument with a base and framework made of brick or supported by 2 6x6 square posts. So essentially what you're talking about are two posts and a sheet of plywood nailed between them. That would violate the tenets of our ground signs in the city, which are required to be monument style. And monument means the sign is flush with the base and the base is flush with the ground. There is no means for light to pass through them.
So for practical purposes, since this is stricken through, now the document we're working on,
you would have to add it back. Correct. Okay. You would have to make a floor amendment right now and reinstall that. Other than that, it would be my suggestion that, as you have comments, I know it takes a long time and I apologize profusely, but we really need to go through it page at a time, a section at a time. Make your notes, and we'll track them in advance of the second read. This is a document that the staff is certainly very proud of. And I know that the sign committee has worked hard, and they're pleased with the document, as well as the overwhelming support from the community council and the planning commission. So I'm available for any of your questions.
All right. Any questions for Howard?
I don't really have any, Howard. I've got a lot of things that we can discuss here, but I think we can discuss those when we get down here to the first read.
Okay.
That's agreeable with everybody?
Yep.
All right. Thank you, Howard. All right, if there are no objections, I'm going to open public comments. Seeing that there are no objections, public comments are now open. Anybody that wishes to speak in favor of these text amendments, if you could please make your way to the podium.
Let me clear it up to everybody. We will make comments, but other than the comments we make, we concur with what the staff has done.
Sure. Okay. Anybody else wish to speak in favor of this?
Can I ask a question?
You can speak in favor of this, or you can speak against. Anybody wish to speak against this? All right, seeing that there's none. If there are no objections, I'm going to close the public hearing. All right, public hearing is closed, and Sharon, we are at your disposal.
An ordinance amending Chapter 21, signs, and Chapter 27, zoning ordinance of the City of Dunwoody Code of Ordinances by amending sign regulations.
Thank you. All right, with that, let's start the party, right? Let me look to my left. Bill, you don't have a microphone in hand, so you might want to pull your chair up to that thing.
I get on it.
Howard, likewise.
It's not that me.
Okay. All right, so let me throw it over to my left here. Right. Robert, shoot.
Okay, so I'm going to suggest a few changes that I think are pretty easy and that are pretty non-controversial, just to get the ball rolling. And I did send all of these around beforehand. And Howard, if you think any of these are ill-conceived, I'd love your thoughts on that. I noted in the definition of animated signs, my reading of that, that's page 3, was that you could interpret it to include hand-carried signs. And I felt like we want to protect people's rights to stand on a street corner and say, impeach Robert Wittgenstein, or, you know, I hate taxes, or whatever. And so I'd just like to add clarity that perhaps we add a sentence that says, hand-carried signs containing no electronic or mechanical parts or elements are excluded.
We asked that same question of Ms. Henderson, because I won't say we have a problem, but we have a lot of calls about the folks that stand on the side of the road dressed in costumes, yes, and uniforms and draw attention. And she said to treat those individuals as animated signs themselves, and they can be cited. And it also counts for the idea of the folks carrying handmade signs, because we don't read the sign to enforce it.
I don't care what it says. So we ought to allow people to walk around carrying signs. Yes, I suppose we could cite people doing that, but I don't think as a policy matter I want to. I think we ought to, again, it's a nuisance to have somebody in a gorilla suit jumping up and down at the corner with a sign that says free first month's rent. But I don't care what the sign says. I'm willing to let somebody jump up and down in a gorilla suit. So I think we ought to exclude the carriage hand-carried signs. I think they should not be considered. And frankly, I think we have First Amendment.
There were two instances where she talked about where you can actually read a sign to enforce the nature of the sign. One of which was warning signs. So you can have the directional signs fall under the category of warning signs because they're used to limit the interference of vehicular traffic, especially vehicles and pedestrians. And the other was non-commercial speech. She said if somebody is displaying a sign of non-commercial speech, then it can be occasionally exempted. A good example of that would be political signs. During the political season, you can have an unlimited number of signs related to the election itself without penalty. So we could try and put some text in there that reads that non-commercial speech that's handheld is not applicable.
I want us to encourage freedom of expression here. Right? So if we can find some wording that helps make it clear that we're protecting that, that would make me feel better. And again, I don't know how to do it, but the idea that somebody can't stand up with a sign and as long as they're willing not to plant it in the ground, right? As long as they're willing to stand up there and hold it, I feel like they ought to have a right to do that.
Are you okay with trying to get verbiage on commercial versus non-commercial, or do you want to allow it all?
Well, what do you guys
think? I'm definitely against the commercial aspect,
but you can try that. All
right. She's pointed out some case law of where that nuisance is actually more than a nuisance. It can be a hazard because, you know, some of the ploys they'll use is to simulate running into traffic. and have somebody stand on the break.
Is okay, all right.
Yeah, that would be fine. Everybody ought to be able to
get in that. That's one of the items I've got. I just got handheld signs. I just got Robert's stuff right here, but I...
Okay. All right, you'll work on that. I thought that for consistency's sake, also on page 3, definition of banner, that we might want to include vinyl and canvas simply because we, later in the document, we describe a variety of different materials and we include vinyl and canvas there. So, just for consistency. Anybody have any objections to that?
No.
That's fine. And I saw the typo on the definition of a business date. Yeah. Anybody have any objections to taking out the definition of a substandard lot, since it's not referenced anywhere in the document? That's all. So it's page 5. It says lot substandard definition.
No. I mean,
and it didn't belong in there. It's got to be left out.
And I'm gonna put an asterisk just to power or Bill or legal eagles if there's anything that I don't think there's any of these, Robert, on yours that are going to be applicable. But I might never. But. All right.
On page 8, Article 2, Section 1, there's a reference that says, except for the signs which may be erected without obtaining a permit. And then it goes on to say, what I thought we should reference that those are listed and outlined in Article 3, Section 1 of the chapter, just to be a little more specific.
A little more clarity.
So I don't think that's anything but a...
And Howard, Robert has these as well, that
old... Yeah, I sent them to you, right, Howard? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so there's none of these should come as a surprise to anybody. I sent them to Bill. Again, page 11, the next one there, is about hand-carried signs. And I just want us to have as much freedom in that as we can. And that's the ones that are non-controversial. You want me to go on to the ones that may have some controversy attached to it? Okay, so the first one that I think has got some controversy is page 11 and 12, section 2. There is a new provision in here.
Page what, Robert?
It's the bottom of page 11. Starts at the bottom of page 11. Top of page 12 is section 2. And it's a new provision that requires all owners of property to put their street number up in a visible way. And I'm uncomfortable with that. I want to encourage people to do it. I'm even willing to subsidize them doing it. But I don't want to cite them for not doing it. And if we're not going to cite them for not doing it, we shouldn't make it into a law. We should only have laws on the books that we are willing to enforce. And I'm all for people putting their street number signs up, and the Boy Scouts should go around and do it, and we should put inserts in the crier that encourage people to do it, but I don't think we should make it illegal not to have your street sign on your property.
It already is. The building code, International Property Maintenance Code, and the building code both require.
That's what I remember. I remember
the other discussion about should it be you have to paint it on the curb or where you have to put it. I guess we're just so. Is it necessary to restate a law that's already?
It's really appropriate.
No, it's not necessary, but I think it is appropriate to put it in the sign ordinance because when folks say, "Oh, that's a sign," let's see what the requirement is. That the first thought is not to go to the building code or to go to the property maintenance code; it's to go to the sign code. We could put a note in there that reads consistent with the IPMC.
I was about to say if we could maybe reference that to you, Robert. I don't know. That's.
Give me a beer. I've got it written down here, but I can't find it. What page are you on again?
Top of page 12.
Top of page 12.
Article 3, Section 2.
Yeah.
It's just one of the changes. Is that the all structures throughout the city?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I think the thing I would be opposed to is if it made you paint them on your curb or put them on your forehead or something like that. But as far as how you do it, I don't really care. But I don't know.
You can either put it on the wall, the mailbox, the curb, or the door.
So this is allowed us to
identify the structure.
This is required somewhere?
Currently, yes. Which is restated here because the requirement is actually a sign requirement. So I thought it was important to put it into an area where folks might logically go to look for sign information.
Mr. Mayor?
Yeah.
The sign committee
did recommend it strongly for several reasons. For safety, for fire, for police, and ironically for the average citizen who's driving down the street and happens to see an accident or a crime. And I guarantee you the vast majority of them don't know where they are on the street unless they're on the home street. And if you call 911, you have to tie an address to a reporter. They won't send the fire truck or the police. So the vast majority of mailboxes already have them now, or should, and the same with businesses. So we felt like it's an important thing to put in there.
Okay. Yeah, that's, I've got something else, Mark, Robert, a little bit different, but this is also for not just residential, right?
It's the whole city.
The whole city.
How does all structures.
And when I was reading through this, how does this work the way the bill, again, to stay up here cause between one of you, but on a commercial building, I'm thinking of my building, you know, if you're a 14-story building and you have, I don't know how many tenants, maybe 50, 60, 70 tenants within the structure of the building. And right now the signage is basically nothing. You know, there's some marquee, the marquee clients get little signage running at the road, and then when you pull up into the property, there's just a little. So I, as a tenant, would not have to put my...
You know, it's the idea out structure. Right. The idea out front, it would be an inclusive number, 1 to 12, whatever it is. And then as the mailman comes inside or the fire or anybody else, then it would be on your door.
Okay, so there's no...
No, you wouldn't have to put any sign up there. It would be an inclusive sign on the building. Okay. Or the structure. We call it the structure.
So the inclusive sign meaning, let's say it starts from 100 to 15,000.
Exactly. It would say from 100. They do that now in a lot of shopping centers. Dunwoody Village, just for example, is X through Y.
All right, so Robert, getting back...
What do you guys think?
I think adding in, it's already a law. I do agree it would be helpful to restate it. Just for those who are looking through the sign code. So it's not anything that would be nothing new for doing. So I think if we reference that,
I'd rather not, but this is not a hill to climb. It's not going to drastically change the way we live. So moving on. The next comment, and I think this was probably not intentional, was that we appear to have outlawed colored string lights throughout the city. So the way this is written, a homeowner, and I got a homeowner across the street who loves to put up very colorful lights along their house. The way it's written today, it looks like that would not be legal. And I suspect, being the property rights kind of guy that I am, that I'd object to that.
Yeah. If I may, one of the things we had to do when we renewed this was take out of the definitions some instructions.
That's right.
Wrong place for them. Right. Well, somehow or another, and I'll take blame for it, somehow or another, some of those instructions were taken out, put in the back. And when we get to string lights, there's several entries. I'd be glad to address what we want to do to fix it.
Yeah, okay, good. My last comment from my walkthrough was that I'm noting that we are increasing the amount of signage we're allowing in Dunwoody Village. So what we see there today, some of it's non-compliant. So what you see there today may already be bigger than what we allow. But we are, the way this is written, is it allows in the village considerably more signage. Double the amount of signage for lots that contain 9 or fewer stores.
And you have to just think of square feet.
Square feet, right, square feet. And almost double the amount of signage for lots that contain more than 9 stores. And I think I'm okay with that. I mean, I think we're in an environment where businesses need the help we can give them. We don't want the fact that somebody can't find a store to be the reason that the store goes out of business. There are a lot of restrictions, and I'm perfectly prepared to accept it, but we should do it knowing that we're doing it.
I have got that ground sign 8x8, too big, 6x8 max. And then item G below it, I put 8x8 max. That's, I think, 9 or bigger. 9 or more, I'm sorry, 9 or more.
9, can we
Bill.
Just like Bill was.
Bill, you have to stand up.
You're not, ask Tom to stand up.
You have to throw the baton to the other Bill.
I'm not really sure what it was. You had a size of like a tar baby. The more you poke around, the worse trouble you get into.
I agree with your
statement. I'm speaking as a chamber right now. I agree with your statement. And actually, I got swayed. I'm the one that said that I think we have to understand that not all businesses can do brick faces on their signs. And that's an expensive thing to do. And then I looked in front of my building, and that's a great example of way too many signs. And so I'm in your camp on this one. This does not address that problem. But I think we ought to go back and see if we can't do something about curb cuts. Because it's just, we got, you know, that stretch of Mount Vernon on both sides of it are awful.
But not in the side ordinance, we can't. We can't do anything about curb cuts in the side ordinance, right?
No, I'm not saying any curb cut. I'm saying we're going to,
signs in relationship with the curb cut.
Yeah, I'm speaking about something that sort of came up after this was written. I think we ought to limit signs to be where the curb cut is. And we ought to have them, you know, have one sign and have my little thing, and I'm going to get killed by everybody that's in there. By the way, I'm probably going to get fired as the chairman of the chamber, but that's fine. I think we ought to only allow two signs in my office, or three signs in my office park, because we've got three curb cuts. I think that would be true across the street. What we tried to do is raise it to 6x6 to get more beef to it, but we didn't deal with the quantity, and the quantity is a problem.
I agree with the point of this problem. Howard, is this something we can do in the next version of this to try to address in the overlay district?
Not so much the size that bothers me.
Right.
But
how many buildings are there in that building? Is that all one?
Nine or so.
No.
I'm not for or against the square feet in here. I just want to point out it's about half what is allowed in the city code.
Yes, right.
Still a lot less. Our intent, our intent was, y'all instructed me for both committees to be business friendly. So our intent was here to give them widths and heights, and they have the variation, the flexibility, without telling us all this minutia that we can control it, make it a simpler thing, and make it business friendly.
That was my last thing, but Howard, do we have a way that we could address the problem that Bill Grant's talking about?
Which is,
okay.
It's the sign ordinance. Not the overlay ordinance, the sign ordinance. That, go back to chapter 21, right. It talks about the number of signs you can have. And the overlay describes the time, manner, and place of those signs.
Right.
But the way it reads right now, you're only entitled to one ground sign per street frontage.
Okay.
That's even fewer than per curb cut. You can have three curb cuts from the same parcel going onto the same street. The way that it reads today is that you
can... But those are non-compliant, right?
Say again?
So those signs on that...
They're lawful non-conformities, to the best of our knowledge. So we allow them to be exchanged, panel exchanged, but if somebody comes in for a new requirement, they're going to have to show me that they don't already have a street sign on that frontage on that lot.
So there's nine, let's say there's nine, and I don't know what the number is, but if I was to guess nine separate owners, at least... Because I guess some of those are condos, so you have one building could be four owners. But so each separate would fall under the frontage rule, right? So each building
it's structure, not owner, right?
It's actually lot.
It's lot,
not structure.
Okay.
Even if the lot size are based on the lot. If the lot is 400 acres and there's one entrance in and right onto the street, and, you know, that's the only way to get there. That's where the sign goes, and everybody shares it.
Cool. I'm good.
I think this is just a general comment. I think Bill's comment about what is in good taste and what is not in good taste is in the eye of the beholder is a very true statement. One of the first meetings that I had, and John Hennigan and I had that meeting with the Peachtree Middle School, was on the area of signage. And I always marveled at DHA and all the time they spent on signage. I think we certainly owe them debt of gratitude for what they did to make our city not look like Roslyn Road. The signage is there. But what I want to get to is I think there should be some exceptions in some of these areas.
made, particularly with our school systems. If you go to every school in Dunwoody, you'll find signs there that have these little placard cards and they put up messages on those signs. And in my taste, that's not good taste to do that. But they need the ability to communicate with the students, with the parents, and with the community as to what's going on in the school. And this is an ever-changing thing. And even on school days, as we met with the principal of Peachtree Middle School, on school days, they need to have different messages there. If it's a rainy day, they need to have messages there that might say they'd like to have something that says drive safely or something of that nature. And they'd like to be able to change these things as they need to within their building, not go out and put up these little place cards up there. And so I think for us to exclude LED, LCD type signage, particularly in our schools, and I would probably want to change the ordinance to exclude schools from LCD and LED type signs so that they can in fact do these kind of things in the school, in the principal's office, or someplace in the administrative office, make these changes, make signs on the school grounds. We don't control that anyway, but we've had more problems on signage on the school grounds at Dunwoody Elementary, East Street Middle School, than virtually anywhere. And I think we need to adapt ourselves because this is modern technology. We don't want our city to start looking like Las Vegas, and I think that's what we're trying to get to here. But I think there are exceptions that could be made that would be done in good taste, that would be appropriate for that particular area, and it would not distract from the community itself that it's part of.
The school system specifically is already exempted from our sign ordinance, as they're exempted from our zoning ordinance. So if they choose to put up changeable message text sign, they're completely entitled to do so.
I think it would be nice to include that in here so that we don't, you know, I'm telling you, I've gotten several emails over the past 18 months having to do with school systems not complying with the Dunwoody sign ordinance policy. We need to make sure that if they are excluded, let's reference that in our sign ordinance. And anything that we would allow them to do, let's put it in there so they'll know what would be agreeable to us for them to do.
And then understand that this ordinance actually precludes changeable message text for gas stations. So a gas station right now wouldn't be able to display the price of fuel on the sign because those are changeable message text signs. The idea of the LEDs and the LCDs and other animated signs like that, unfortunately, schools and the gas stations just got thrown out with the bathwater because the potential for unintended consequences and nuisance signage is far outstrips the usefulness of those LED signs.
Isn't there a state law that requires gas stations to post their current price?
I'm not aware, so I can look for that. I've never heard that before.
Okay.
Can I ask a question? Can a gas station get a sign variance that would allow them to? I mean, so one way to deal with this would be not to make exclusions, but to tell folks, you know what, if you need this, then you go to the ZBA and you get a sign variance, and then we put our stamp on it.
Okay, that is the way I would deal with it, because putting that blanket exclusion of the sign ordinance may invite a First Amendment violation, because excluding school board speech is unequal. It's an equal protection problem that we may run into. So while they're already not bound by our sign and zoning ordinance, I think we should leave it at that, because putting something that could be facially deemed to be unconstitutional could be problematic to our sign ordinance as a whole.
What's the unconstitutional nature of them being able to display a sign?
Because it's their speech. If no one else is able to do it, but they can, that means only their speech is allowed versus everyone else is on a particular sign.
They're afforded a privilege not afforded to other people in the same zoning district.
Yeah, it's an equal protection and a First Amendment problem.
Okay, I'll be able to.
Okay, thank you, Mike. All right, can I come to me? I'm just going to ask for some examples. I'm getting a little bit confused with some of the stuff. I'm not real smart.
All right.
Okay. Look at Article 3. It's page 11 that I'm looking at that I printed off.
It's just one page.
Number 3, I just wanted, these are Section 1 exemptions from permit requirements. And number 3, one suspended sign per tenant of a multi-tenant building when the area of the sign is less than 6 square feet per side. What
Can you give me an example of what that would be?
Traditionally called a shingle. I mean, it's the little L bracket that comes out, and you can suspend the sign from the side of the doorway or next to the door.
Okay.
Turning it off.
Got it.
What? That shingle? No, I'm putting up
a shingle. That's a warning sign.
Okay. I apologize. I'm
trying to stay away.
Okay, wonderful.
And if I'm carrying a sign that says to him his neighbor, is that a warning sign?
Non-commercial speech, so that should probably be all right.
All right. And then there's the, we've already talked about the lights that Robert has pointed out. So bear with me, let me go through here. And Jenny, are we working our way through some of your items?
That's a long page.
You know, yeah. Hey,
you have
many pages?
2.5 pages.
All right. Page 22, section 20. Temporary event fund. All right, there's a whole lot to this, I know, but again, can I get an example of what would fall under this?
These are your pole banners.
Okay, just pole banners.
Yeah, if you read the whole way through it, it basically only addresses pole banners.
Okay,
the nature, the size of the sign, the location of the sign, the height above grade of the sign.
Okay.
They're talking about the quack and the feathers and the.
Yeah. Okay, and what about B, directional sign? What's it? That's an example of, what would be an example of that?
Those would be temporary signs of, you know, parkings, bathrooms, road closed.
Okay, it's got to be a public announcement, which a public announcement would be eggs on sale for 98 cents. That's not a public announcement?
No, because that wouldn't necessarily be permitted in conjunction with a special event.
Okay, so they're all special events. Okay, got it. Yep.
On that first point, Howard, my question was, are 3 times a year too few in... I've got another word here, but Lenny will jump on it and seem to say it. But you know, I just thought of the churches. But there could be other, you know, the Boy Scouts.
Are you back to section 19 now, on the previous page?
Yeah, I'm section 19, number 5.
Yes.
14 days, no more than 3 14-day periods per calendar year. I just throw that out for discussion here. You know, is 3 too few? You know, I mean, what if the Boy Scouts have a pancake dinner, and the church has this, and I don't know who else has
Bill's. I will summarize my feelings before Bill speaks, and just saying that the number of displays per year is consistent with page 1, which is the purpose and findings. So that's why we feel comfortable having it in there.
We debated this on the committee, and we started lower and got higher, and we hit what we call the happy medium that people wanted. We didn't go to the max number, which sometimes people do it because that sort of leaves the door open.
We could, on another place in this, try doing the differentiation between commercial and non-commercial, which you get on very, the Supreme Court has not been favoring that, but they haven't specifically overruled it yet. We could try that.
Let's not go to the Supreme Court. All right, well, you're not satisfied. At this point, the committees have done a ton of work in the community council.
We stayed away from commercial versus residential whenever we could.
You mean, yeah, okay.
Well, anything.
I understand. Yeah. Okay.
So a directional sign for a real estate firm that wants to show that the house down the street is for sale.
That's not on the event, I don't think.
No, that's a different world, I think.
That's not covered in that.
Yeah, those directional signs we don't actually label as directional signs. They fall into the category of standard informational signs, which have their own set of rules and regulations as far as square footage and location. When they're placed in the right way, they're illegal, and we remove them. We have sign sweeps about 2 or 3 times a year when we go through, and we're noticing that there's fewer and fewer instances of those signs. But we don't actually read those to regulate them. There either is a sign or there is not a sign, and it's either the correct dimensions and location or it's not.
First of all, I want to thank Bill and the entire committee, the staff,
for all this work that they've done on this. This is tiresome work, this is tedious work, and as Bill said in his opening remarks, a number of people, if we have different opinions of tacky versus non-tacky, I'm sure that beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. But thanks, Bill, the rest of the committee, all of you that worked on this, Howard, all the staff. You all deserve a vote of thanks for
it. I hope you father's still get to tell you the other changes.
Listen, I'll applause any time here. But anyway, I've got a few items, and you never give a guy like me something to look at. Number one, on page one, you know, just a clerical thing, is real small. Fourth page, fourth sentence down here. You've got too many ands in there. It says to public safety as a traffic hazard and a deterrent to property, and that and before a deterrent to private property values needs to be taken out. There's a paragraph two, fourth line up from the bottom, there's a triple or quad space there after the word even. Those are easy. I had something about the animated signs. I kept thinking about when we were running Dunwoody Yes, when we were voting for the city that day, we all had Dunwoody Yes signs out there, and I thought, whoops.
And that should be legal. We should be able to.
Well, they're non-commercial, so that'd be okay. That's non-commercial. Okay. Let me go to page four, paragraph five. I can find it. The top. Direct lighting. Direct lighting shall mean a specific type of illumination where the source of the light is internal and integrated to the sign structure, and where the big glasses here tonight, so help me out. Resolute illumination radiates out in the direction of the viewer. Does that mean that you know, there's a light, kind of like I went by and a flashlight shining on my mug? Or does that mean that there is something that's just the light as wood?
It's a lid cabinet. Yeah. Essentially. So just imagine a box with two acrylic
panels. It doesn't mean the light's shining out in the
street. No, that would be indirect light.
Okay. Let me scratch around on these as I go by, if it's okay with you guys. Okay, page four. Paragraph four in the bottom. It's a entry into a named residential area. Let me see if I can get that one. Find that one. Page four, paragraph four. Entry into a entrance sign.
Entrance sign shall mean any ground sign placed at the intersection of a public street and a private entrance into an apartment, office, condominium, church, or industrial complex, or some other building with multiple residential.
My question is, why isn't a named residential area included in that? I guess that's my question.
I think that probably falls under the definition of a subdivision sign later on page 7.
Okay. Is it in there?
Subdivision signs shall mean any ground sign placed at the intersection of two roads, at least one of which is a public road, with the other road being the main thoroughfare into and out of a commercial or residential subdivision.
The sign just has to deal with commercial, basically. Okay. Okay, page four, paragraph nine. Created after the enactment of the ordinance. Which controls all the aspects of the lot? So, you know, the created after paragraph 9 should be...
I'm sorry, you're on page 4? Yeah. Is that in definitions?
Yeah.
What word are you defining? Can you tell me the first word in the sentence?
Yeah, I'm trying to find it right now. Paragraph 9. I kind of go down from the top, so what I did.
Is that an electronic sign?
Created after the enactment. Something about creating after the enactment of the ordinance. Am I?
I don't believe it's on page 4.
Let me see. just, as you're trying to find it, it points out the very difficult transition between paper and PC, and the area between the two. It's just a paradox. It's hard to
get. Anyway, I'll come back to that. Okay, page 6, paragraph 1. Page 6, paragraph 1. Non-conforming. Those signs are not considered illegal, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. But they would be if you went in and if it wasn't an act of God or something else. I think there's another term, something happened beyond your control. If I went in and changed that non-conforming sign, then it would be illegal. Is that correct?
Trying to follow if okay, the wind blows it down or somebody knocks it down.
Yeah, there's two things I know that a non-conforming sign that you can replace.
Specific language
that
you hear about.
Replace a non-conforming sign.
I believe they are allowed to be replaced under
Acts of God. Yes. Some unusual thing.
But if you otherwise choose to replace it, you need to come into modern day.
You have to come into conforming. Okay, thanks. Okay, page 7, first paragraph. I'm sorry to be so tedious, but, you know, it's just the way life goes, I guess. Okay.
Sorry about roof sign.
Tail end attack. Yeah, encroachment onto or extending above the sloping phase of a manual roof, blah, 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 or any combination thereof. Is it okay for a sign to be signed to attach to? What can the sign attach to? Attach to? Read that and see if that makes sense to you.
The ground
or
the wall.
Or a sign attached to, encroaching into, or extending above? Is that?
Or a sign attached to the sloping phase of a mansard roof. What we've done is introduced a couple other concepts. A sign attached to, comma, encroaching into, or extending above the sloping phase of a mansard roof. So there's three instances where a sign could interact with the sloping phase of a mansard roof. If it's attached to it, if it encroaches into it, or extends above it.
Okay.
We just about tried to cover every conceivable possibility there could be that somebody would put a sign on the roof.
Okay. Page 7 again. Paragraph 3 from the bottom. Oh, that's just the... If it's going to be titled multi-phase sign, I thought it should be alphabetical order.
You're right. It's still in the T's.
Page 8, number 5. I thought that... this has to do with what the sign's going to look like and, you know, for the approval. And I thought that somebody should, maybe it says it in there, maybe it's implied, but let me know that they should be the type of sign to be erected, the area of the sign, the height, and all this other good stuff, and the explanation of how the sign is to be mounted or erected. I thought in there should be an artist's drawing of the sign or some picture of the drawing. I've read all these. I did not see that in here. It seems to me like one picture's worth a thousand words. There should be an artist's rendering of the sign or something.
And often we do get renderings submitted. Occasionally there'll be a photograph of the area where the sign's going to be installed, and they'll superimpose a rendering of the sign on that. But we don't require that specifically because we don't want to give off the appearance of prejudging the sign if it meets the code. So we don't want to review the sign aesthetically because we don't have design guidelines. We need to review it analytically and find out whether or not it's correct for height, location, its placement. If they bring in a sign and say it's going to look like that, you're right, we could look at it and say, oh, that's very pleasing, we like that. But we could also look at it and say, oh, God, that's terrible. No, we've got to figure out a way not to do that. We don't want to give off the airs that we're doing that.
Well, later on in here, you say things about a sign cannot include, vulgar language and all that other good stuff. That seems like that would kind of
clear that item up a little bit. I don't know, what does everybody think? Am I being too picky here or what?
I'm not sure that you can make looking at the sign part of the criteria for approval. I think that's the point, is we don't have to like the way it looks. We only have to set the rules up and say it can't be bigger than this or placed there or higher than this. When we start looking at the sign, we get into what's tacky and what's not, and you're in, we're in quicksand.
Well, as I'm looking at this, the application information, and you know, this is, I looked at this, that's it. You know, I can have a couple of four-letter words and what haven't you up there, and basically I've complied with your application information, is what I'm saying.
Right. You can cite them for having obscenity, right? You can cite them for having words that you're not allowed to display in public. So that's not an issue. But you couldn't cite them if
I'm not looking at that, right? I'm just looking, you know, one picture is worth a thousand words. You know, somebody says, oh, hey, you can't put a picture of, whatever it is. I'm not going to say it here, but whatever it is. You can't put that there. I just thought that would be a clarification item. But, you know, I'm not going to go to that with that. So, what do you think?
We can regulate the signs for obscenity and vulgarity, and we can also regulate the signs to make sure that they don't mimic official signs. You can't use a stop sign or, you know, a yield sign as your advertisement.
Okay.
That's really pretty close to about as far as we go right now with regulating them, other than the election, the non-commercial election speech.
Okay, this might be covered below, but one of the items I thought we, and I think that's not included in this, is a copy of the current paid business license for the business requesting the sign. If you go down to B below somewhere here, item B down there says the director shall develop the forms, and then it says the application, each applicant in C, the applicant shall apply for the permit and license with all the state and regulations. No sign permit shall be valid unless the requirement permits and license. Maybe that states that. Is that state that there? What I'm saying is, if we got somebody out there that doesn't have a business license and comes in, you know, it seems to me like it should be one of the requirements is that they have a business license, and that's a double check for our folks also.
We had some recent and local case law on that exact.
You can't just limit signs to business owners. As a property owner, I have no business license, I have a right to apply for a sign permit.
Okay, how about if you state if the entity is a business, then a business license would be?
I think that would be covered by C, where it requires them to have all the permits and licenses.
Is it all in there? You comfortable?
I am comfortable with it, yes, sir.
I'm comfortable with it. Okay, page 9, section 3. I think the 20th business day, and the lawyers there, I'm not a lawyer, but even I think I can see a hole in that. The definition of what is the 20th business day? Yeah, that's business days, but how is that letter notified? Is that letter, I just said something here, the 20th business day will be determined by the date the letter is in the hands of, so the date the letter is hand-delivered or postmark date of the first class letter. In other words, is the date, 20th day, the day I received the letter, or is it the day that it's postmarked? And I thought that clarification needed to be done there.
Under the law, usually refers to postmark unless otherwise stated.
Okay, will that hold up in court?
Absolutely. All of the usual requirement for dates, mailings, and notices under any provision of law usually is identified as you mailed it on a certain day, it meets the criteria of being postmarked on that day. Because even under litigation.
You all are happy with it? I just thought that I thought that was a loophole there. And again, I'm not going to apologize anymore. But paragraph 9, section 4A. I hear something that bothers me about halfway down that paragraph, because this is kind of an IRS deal. You know, the IRS, you can call the IRS and say, listen, I've got a question on my taxes here. Can you where this way, and they'll tell you everything you have to do, and you can write down the name and the ID number of the person, and do it exactly like they said, and if that person was wrong, the IRS can come after you. And I looked down here and I saw this about line, what line is it there, line 7, it says, or that a permit has been erroneously issued in violation of this chapter. You know, if it's our fault, if we tell the individual, whether it be a resident or a business, that, okay, you are in compliance, here's your permit, and then we come back and say, oh, not so fast, we made a mistake. I think that should fall upon us. That's our problem. And I do not think that the individual should lose their permit or their sign or whatever it is because of whatever they've gone through. But once we have told them that they can do it, where else are they going to go? We should be the final one. And if we say, Mr. Brown, everything is in order, here's your permit, then that should fall on us. Mr. Brown should not be brought in under any circumstance, the way I look at it.
I'll cite an example of why that should work, should be allowed to work. Several years ago, the real estate company put up a sign to enter Dunwoody Village from Shandy Dunwoody. It turned out to be that somebody at DeKalb County gave them permission, but it was wrong. And they put it within the right-of-way, and it was a safety hazard because the right-of-way there is wider than it normally is at most streets, 75 feet, 150 feet, 75 on each side. They went back to the county and they protested in court, and they had to take the sign down and make it a proper sign. Otherwise, we would have had a huge sign, or it was erected, and we would have had a sign forever that was a safety hazard. So there is precedent for doing that, and it did stand up court.
We got stipulations later here about safety hazards and everything.
I understand. I'm just saying it was even debatable whether or not it was safety, but in my mind it was. But the point was it allowed the governing authority to correct the issue even though an employee innocently made a mistake. That's the way I interpret it.
Well, I believe that we or our representative, you know, should have the proper information, and if we do not give that to the citizen or business, then we should hold ourselves accountable and not the citizen. That's my feeling on that, and I'm one vote, but I feel very strongly on that. Let's put it like that.
Does it make any difference that they would have the opportunity to go to the CBA? In other words, one problem, and as the problem Bill pointed out, is that if you allow a sign to go up, that is a safety hazard, it's now a non-conforming legal sign, right? You can never get rid of it. Because once it doesn't matter how much time elapses, it's now in that category that says, yeah, well, it was legal then, even though it's not legal now, it can stay there until it rots. If you allow the city to revoke a sign permit that was improperly issued, and you allow the signed petitioner to go to the CBA and let the CBA say, yeah, the city screwed up, you should be allowed to keep that sign or not, does that give you the safety valve that make you feel more comfortable?
Gives me some. Yeah. I just think that always, you know, that if you make a decision or your representative makes a decision, you know, if I go to a car dealer and the guy says, you can have that car for $1,000, and I say, roger that, I'll sign that. And he comes back and says, oh, not so fast, or that told me $2,000. I think, you know, any way you look at it, you know, the IRS, any of this stuff that you look at, and by the way, I've never had that happen with the IRS, just so you, any IRS register, probably Maloney, all Irish people work for this, by the way. I just have this problem that, oh gosh, I made a mistake, sorry about that, take it all down. I mean, wow, come on, do you know what you're doing or don't you? Okay. But let's at least hash that one around a little bit. Okay, page 9, 4B. I guess my whole thing there is 90 days enough? That's I'll just ask all the you all up here. If 90, y'all feel 90 days enough, I'll knock John down the line.
Okay. That's actually more than is usually offered by many jurisdictions. Many jurisdictions limit it to 45 days.
Yeah. Okay, and it fits within our ZBA process of 60 days.
Okay. Maybe I even went up to the definitions, but it says, paragraph 9, page 9, I'm sorry, section, paragraph 1, he, she, slash, it.
Where are we?
Good catch.
There's a reason it's in there.
No, it refers to corporations.
Corporations.
They're not a he or a she.
Isn't he or she?
No, corporation is neither a he nor a she. It's an it. And if the corporation files
is there
for
a definition up there at the top?
Absolutely not. It's a common definition of a corporation is either a man nor a woman, but...
Okay. Well, you can make it look like the person's shell, because typically persons are defined as beyond people. We can massage that if so desired.
Okay. All right, well, we'll send that one. We're sending one. Yeah, we're sending one. Okay. Page 10, paragraph 6C. I got something good here. 6C. Line 4 down there, it said, shall be considered a separate violation, and each day of a continued violation for each sign shall be considered a separate violation. So that tells me that if I've got a violation here and today, tomorrow I got 2 violations, the next day I get 3 violations, and on down the line. I don't think that that's, I think, if you got a violation, then I think you ought to have a couple days to resurrect the
churches.
Every day, this could be really something that it can add up. And I don't think that's I don't think that's a common sense approach. I don't think that passes the common sense smell test for me.
What I think you need to avoid is having somebody with an illegal sign just pay the fine and say, okay, it was an illegal sign, but it's $150. I paid the $150. Now I keep the sign.
Okay, so, but what I would say is that, after I massage that to say after 3 days of violation, we consider it done.
On that, to enforce the sign, not only do you have to have the code enforcement willing to issue the citation daily, you would have to have the solicitor willing to present it to the judge, and then the judge also has to be willing to fence them in that matter. And typically that would not happen unless it was very, very egregious. But you do have all your 3 steps involved where that could be.
I understand. I just, I thought that, a daily violation, give somebody a couple days to correct the situation,
That is...
Usually they're given a warning in a certain period of time to correct a violation. If they fail to do that, then they get cited. They've already had their warning. They've already had what you usually give 10 to 20 days for them to fix it. Mm-hmm. So this is a disincentive for continuing to violate, waiting for the court date. The court date's in a half a year. I'll just keep it up for a half a year, and then I'll take it down right before the court date, and the judge will like me. It's a disincentive to continue violating when you've already been cited. It applies to every violation of this code. In fact, in Chapter 1, it states that as well.
Okay, page 11, fees. That's Section 8. I thought it should direct the applicant to some fee structure location. Where is that in reference to where the fees are?
It's on our website. We also have copies of it that we make available to applicants if they ask.
Okay.
It changes often enough that to put it in the document
requires
text.
Put it in there, just where it's at. Yeah, where can
should direct the applicant to where the fee structure is located.
Which can be found.
Which can be found on, yeah. I'm not asking for the fees in there, Howard. I know that. But, yeah, I'm asking for, you know, if I'm reading this, as where are those fees at? If it just says, go to chapter empty frats, it would be simple.
Well, the fee structure is usually obviously not codified. It's in a separate fee schedule.
Exactly.
But what I would say is, you can put it's in the hands of the city clerk because the city clerk is the keeper of all records. But if you start telling them it's on the website and it's not on the website, and they come in and say, oh, that means I don't have to pay.
I
would want to reduce that opportunity.
Something can be found in the offices
of the city clerk, because everything can always be found in the offices of the clerk. I wouldn't want to direct anyone else with the responsibility. And if she loses it, then
that's her responsibility.
Let me just give you another job. Okay, however you want to word that in there, that'd be fine. Thanks. Okay, thank you. Window signs. Why are window signs, just keep smarten me up, why are window signs exempt from permits when all other signs aren't?
Couldn't tell you, to be honest. It was just part of the code.
I think if cantaloupes are on sale free for $1 this week, that you might not want to get a permit for that.
Where's that at?
If you further into the ordinance, you'll find that window signs are limited to a very small size.
I saw that.
But you don't want to say they can't have a window sign because it includes the glass next to it. And if you don't allow that or exempt that in this case, then they couldn't put open, closed, all those other kind of small signs. That's what that's intended to help.
Okay, I just wondered why everybody had to pay for every other sign, why the window signs got a good
There are other exemptions.
Huh?
There are other exemptions down below.
Okay. Glad you guys gave this all to me. Okay, page 11, number 4. That's the 4 inches and the 10 inches in residential sole purpose of displaying the street numbers as may be required by ordinance or other signs required by law. I guess it made me believe that, you know, you can only have one size of sign. Signs here, the 4-inch ones for the district residential and the 10-inch ones for the other places. But
those are the maximums. They can be smaller than that.
Okay. If required, is required by ordinances or other signs required by law. Now, are there other ordinances or signs required by law that changes this?
Yeah, Chapter 7 is our building code. And there's some language in there about the requirement to have your address. And then the International Property Maintenance Code, which we've also adopted, also has a requirement in there that structures show their address to the street, notably for public safety.
I was just going to say that that's maximum size. As long as they're readable from the street, that's part of it.
Okay.
Readable by who?
Discernible with somebody with good eyesight.
Or thick glasses.
Okay, well, we've already discussed the numbers on residents mandatory, so we have that written down. Number, page 12, paragraph 10. I was wondering, why is there a requirement for the name and address of the person responsible for erecting and maintaining the sign? Is not the sign permit number, would that not reference back? Why do we have to put somebody's name and address on the sign?
So the individual inspecting the sign would have the information on hand immediately, rather than making their research project back at the office.
Yeah, but if he's got the permit number, he's got the permit number, all he has to do is pull that up and whack, there it is. Seems like that's just extraordinary work that's not
It's not always the people who have access to that information who seek to contact those people. Occasionally, if the sign is for some reason a hazard, let's say somebody crashes into a monument sign and there's power to it, they want to call the sign company to find out what they can do about the public safety response of getting the sign turned off or for whatever reason.
I don't know about that argument.
I
like it.
You like the sign?
Yeah, I like it. Plus, if you like it, you can hire the people.
It's been a problem just in history. Dealing with this to try to track people down. It's kind of like the burned down house that you can't find the owner to clean up the yard. That same type of a problem.
Okay. Okay. Paragraph, page 13, section, paragraph 24, 25. Okay, spring lights. I picked up the spring lights, I guess, like Robert did, except with noted a bug. And I thought that since this is what's not or prohibited.
Prohibited
signs. Then it gets down to string. Number 24 is string lights. Mm-hmm. And then I just said that except as noted above. Because it is above, you can put string lights in the middle.
Howard, if you want to
clarify. Somewhere.
Can we do that? That was the one I talked about earlier that didn't transpose. We took it out of the definitions and put it over here. And I'll give this to Howard, but after string lights, I would put the following words. Exception, white holiday lights shall be exempt from this section, and colored holiday lights and decorations displayed and lit not more than 45 days before and 10 days after a holiday shall be exempt from this section.
If I may, I would put the words except as otherwise permitted herein, and then up where it allows white light, white string lights without a permit, I would add that phrase to that.
That works.
It would make it cleaner. Here it would just say except as otherwise provided. It would direct people.
As long as it's in there, that's
it. Yeah. I already added it.
Okay. So you're just going to prohibit those icicle bells? Is that fair?
Well,
I'm kidding.
You picked the real one here,
Rocky. Okay, so that's fine with me. That will reference it back up. And, you know, number 25 there, does that, and again, you know, I've read through this thing and my eyes were crossing, but does that exclude balloons on residents to announce things like birthdays and births and stuff like that? Because all through the neighborhood, you're going to find it's a boy, you know, happy birthday, you know, on mailboxes.
This document, you're not able to infer context in a sensitive manner.
Right.
And occasionally, because we can't regulate pretty, we have to just, because of the unintended consequences that you don't look for, I understand that it's nice to have the announcement that, you know, blue balloons and it's a boy. But unfortunately, when the Ford dealer down the street puts up a hot air balloon that says 20% off F-150s, they fall into the same category. So what do you do?
Well, that guy who got the Ford dealer.
The big purple monkey with the car over its head on top of the used car dealer. Right. That
life was a lot simpler when I was a kid, I'll tell you that. Okay. Right. Oh, mercy. Is there going to be... You're going to be... Oh, mercy. I don't even want to... Okay, I just brought up, I think Danny brought up the point of, electronic signs, what was the other one, 21, 22, LCD and LED lights, is that something, that's just...
Think around the stadium, the Braves stadium, that's LED. And so if you don't prohibit it, and you say they can do it, you're trying to say how many inches tall, they can have one of those things just running back and forth anywhere in the... So again, it's the unintended consequences of taking that out.
Isn't this built kind of modern technology? You know, LCD and LED and all that?
I understand. I say this is... You, by taking this out, The fear I have is we're going to end up with Las Vegas.
I kind of like Las Vegas.
I don't have done with it.
Okay. I'll acquiesce.
Yeah, just for future reference, I think when we go looking at a perimeter center overlay district, these are places where we'll look to change the rules in that area.
Okay.
You think that would be Las Vegas?
I think what that would do for heads and beds.
Page 14, paragraph 2, to put up a 10 by 10 sign, I just thought to myself, wow, that is a big sign. You know, you can put up one sign. If you don't have any other signs, I can put up one sign, and it can be 10 foot by 10 foot. That's a huge sign. I thought that language needed to be tightened somewhat.
Are you looking at number 2?
Page 14, number 2. Not exceed an aggregate of 100 square feet.
That first aggregate should be struck. I apologize if that's not correct. Development shall not have a sign area exceeding 6 square feet per dwelling unit, and not to exceed an aggregate of 100 square feet for the development. So no, you would not be entitled to have a 10 by 10 sign. You'd be entitled to have... what's that, about 12 or 15 6 square foot signs.
Yeah, but there's nothing in there limits the size. Doesn't tell me how many number I have to have. So if I have my aggregate's 1, I can have a 10 foot by 10 foot. Am I reading that wrong?
One before. No. Again, the first aggregate that's on the second line there, development shall not have an aggregate. Yeah, remove that.
Okay.
That's incorrect. So it should read, lots used for institutional, apartments, condominiums, mobile homes, or townhouse developments shall not have a sign area exceeding 6 square feet per dwelling unit and or not to exceed an aggregate of 100 square feet for the development. So they can the largest single sign you can have is 6 square feet, and you can have a number of those 6 square foot signs up to a total of 100. Once you get to 100, you can
do
more
signs. You're scratching the first aggregate.
That's correct.
Okay. Okay, sounds good. Paragraph 14, paragraph 1, verses 6. One says all kinds of things here about the size of signs, and then 6 says another thing here. Subdivision entrance signs shall not exceed 32 square feet of sign area, excluding the base, and shall not exceed 8 feet in height. Number 1 up here says, lots used for residential purposes other than for institutional blah, 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 shall have an aggregated sign area greater than, shall not have an aggregated sign greater than 16 square feet, with no individual sign exceeding 6 square feet.
Well, we have a separate definition for subdivision sign, we have a separate definition for entrance sign. So the way that this would work out is actually you would be entitled to more than one ground sign, each of its own unique type.
Okay.
Can I ask a question about that? Yes. Subdivision may have a sign that's really an entrance gateway, and on that gateway is the sign. What constitutes the portion of the gateway that's the sign?
The area of the actual message text. It would not comprise the entirety of the structure on which it's mounted. Okay.
So does that make sense to everybody else? Is 1 and 6 okay to everybody else? No problem?
Yeah, I'm okay with those because one is just for the interest of the subdivision, and one is based on the lot, right? And it's true, the lot on the corner is also maybe the interest of the subdivision, so you could end up putting 2 signs there, and that'd be legal.
Okay.
Really, number 6 is almost content management, in that it has a very specific role, which serves a public purpose. Folks can find the development, or they can find the subdivision. But that subdivision may want to put up another sign that, you know, mentions where their swimming tennis is, or that the Sunday they're going to have a swim meet or something to that effect.
Okay. Page 16. I'm moving right through this. Section 9, B.
Section
9B. 150 square feet. That's a pretty big sign the way I looked at it.
But it's 120 feet in the air.
Yeah. Still, it's, 10 by 15, that's a pretty big sign.
I noticed that the one time you scratched different numbers here through the
180.
Yeah. I thought 120 would be big enough, but I just thought that that's an awful big sign. You don't want this to look like Roswell Road, and I just thought that was getting Roswell Road. What's everybody else think?
That bothered me. I mean, I'm thinking of the Phelps Building.
Yeah.
You know, it's way up high, and they want it to be seen from a long way away, and we want somebody to lease that building. I mean, yeah. That's what it comes down to.
Is that Mr. Rubin? Okay, section 9. Section 9-11 there, on page 16, the size of the signs. You got the projecting signs may project from the building 2 feet, blah, blah, and shall be made if less than 10 feet above the ground and erected over a pedestrian walkway or driveway, and no less than 14 feet over vehicle area. If you go down to section 11, it says there's the canopies shall be no less than 8 feet above the ground where when erected over a pedestrian walkway and 14 feet above the vehicle serviceway. Why the differential? Why not the same? Why shouldn't those both be the same?
I would imagine that the canopy height is more reflective of the height of the door, which is typically going to be right around 6'7" or 6'10". You have a canopy that goes flush with the top of the door. The idea of the signage that needs to be 10 feet above the ground, I guess you could raise or lower that as you see fit. I mean, we reviewed the document. You didn't find a problem with it earlier.
Okay. I just thought it would be inconsistent. Both of them are over a pedestrian walkway. Mine's 10 feet, mine's 8 feet. What do you think?
No. I just don't know if the canopy would necessarily work at a 10-foot height if you've got a door that's just a little bit under 7.
I wouldn't raise the canopy up, because the canopy could be able to get wet. So you don't want to make the canopy so high that you don't have the cover. So if you want to allow the mounted sign to come down, I guess I'm okay with that. Nobody's going to hit the canopy with the sun.
Okay. So,
no. Right. Except for Howard.
Section 9. Okay, section 9, then we can change that to 8 feet above the ground level and erected above a pedestrian walkway. I'm happy with that. Just being consistent. Page 17, the table. I just didn't understand. If you can explain to me down there about on line 4, the 500 feet. One sign of 500 square feet. Can you explain that? Is that 500 feet? Is that the actual? It just feels like a very big sign to me. Or a aggregate of signs, I guess, is what it says down there in that the third column over under maximum square feet.
Right. The maximum square footage of any one individual sign can only be 150 square feet. But there will be a time when we have large high-rise buildings with multiple tenants, and they're all going to seek to have signage. So in this instance, you could have three of those up to 150 square feet. With 50 feet of cap left over. No, you will not have one sign of 500 square feet. There's a cap of 150 square feet for any given sign unless you get a variance.
It says that in there?
Yeah. It reads up to a maximum aggregate of 150 for buildings under 12 and up to 500 for, and then earlier you had mentioned that you didn't like the idea of 150 square feet. What now reads 180 square feet, that's where that 150 comes from.
Page 22. What's that? Section 8. Go ahead. Nobody likes flagpoles more than me. I can tell you that. I like flagpoles. Spend a little time underneath them. But I just thought that, having three flagpoles for residents was just a little bit much. I'm thinking about that house in the Springs up there with the guy had the gator sign on it and everything else. I just was wondering, I thought for residential areas, one flight pole would be plenty.
You refer to the swamp house.
I don't refer to the swamp house. The one you like.
The Sandy's pretty.
I think the reason you have it, so it is because you have a state flag, you might have a flag for the business, you might have one for the federal.
Yeah, for commercial, that's fine. Yeah, I can see that.
Well, you get into residential, we talked about that too. If you get into residential, you can have, in my case, I'll have an American flag on a pole in the ground. Other people have it on the side of the house. But there are also people that will have their Georgia flag in addition to an American flag.
That's what you're talking about.
And
or the gator flag.
You mean
the
circle on
the flag?
I think there's a stipulation you can put two flags on one pole.
Not only flag, you can have 14
of them. My point is, in residential areas, there are a lot of people, they're tasteful, but a lot of people will have a flag for the government flag, U.S. and state, and so forth. But they will also have, over the garage, they'll have their Palmetto flag or the Georgia flag or somewhere else. So that's what this is about, is not say they can't do that. You try to get that back in, you're in trouble.
I'm going to raise a Missouri flag on this. Okay, the swamp house came right into mind as soon as I read that.
As with goats, not flags, goats.
Okay, we've already discussed the issue of three times a year, and everybody said that's plenty. And, you know, Bill, your church is one of them that likes to put those flags up, so you can take that heat. Page 23, A3. Aren't you glad there isn't 100 pages? Yeah? A3. Okay, 10 feet from the road. You know, this is... what came to mind there is when we have lemonade days and we have the 4th of July parade, we have those hanging right on the streets, those banners. And just has to do with temporary signs, and that's what they are. Temporary signs is what I figured.
The whole section on pole banners addresses that. That's an exception that Howard talked about earlier, that they reluctant. Now, let me put my words to it. They're reluctantly want to give it a try. Our intention was that a lot of the nonprofits use the same pole banners, the same size and everything. And we think it would be preferable, our committee thought it would be preferable to drive people to pole banners of a standard size and nature, as opposed to having A-frames and all this, and they end up encroaching in the public right away, even though you tell them not to. But if we push them to the pole banners, and they're all standard, now when we get to, I can go further, when they get to the PCID, they're going to want to have pole banners, but they will be a standard size and permanently installed properly.
Okay, I'll go to pole.
I think in the case of some of the planned communities that I've seen in places like Bonita Springs, Florida, where they've designed everything so to be consistent throughout the community, you have pole banners there, and I think that's a great thing to have, because you can show not only events that are going on, but you can have them through... have the seasons of the year, you know, it can be really decorative to the community.
That's what PCID wants to do.
Right. And I think it ought to be consistent throughout the city of Dunwoody.
And that's what we're doing.
Okay. Let me go to pole banners. That's the next thing. Page 24. Is there a way to limit these? The way I read these, anybody can put a pole banner. You know, it's not a civic function or anything else. I can put a short family reunion pole banner. Am I reading that incorrectly?
You are, sir, because it goes back to the, you can't identify by class. We would love to be able to say only nonprofits. We can't do it.
How about city events, city-sponsored events?
You can't do that. You're giving somebody preference over the other, or conversely, you're constraining somebody and not all.
So anybody can put up a pole banner?
Yes, but if you look how carefully we worded it, it's going to be expensive for them to do that. And they've got to have an event, they've got to get a permit to do it.
Okay, page one of the overlay district. Again, you know, Ken said he wasn't very smart, but he's twice as smart as me. So these are just some of the things that popped off of here as I looked at them. Okay, paragraph F,
I don't know which F I got here, but it, you know, the ground signs, 8x8, and F and G. I just thought that, and we just talked about this, I think, a little bit previously, I just thought that those were awful big signs. 8 foot by 8 foot, and then, you know, the other one, I think, is 10 feet by 10 feet, down there at G.
Yeah, Bill.
Bill, you want to...
Is it possible we could delay that? We would like to address signage throughout this, and you take them by exception, and it gets confusing. Can we do that when we do the overlay district?
We can. Okay, fine. Okay, I'm in on it. Okay. The rest of everything I got is overlay district, so we're not going to do the overlay district.
So later.
Okay.
That's just a problem.
Yeah, I do have one thing. We all got an email from Jerry Tanner.
Yep.
It's about right here. And I went through and annotated it. There was one item that I thought she had a good question on, and that was, it says window signs of commercial buildings only on the ground floor. And the question was, what if they're leasing the second floor space? In other words, what if the commercial building is on the second floor? Does that mean you can't have a window sign up there? And I don't know if we thought about that. Typically, we've got only one story commercial buildings, but
it was a long time. If Howard Wilson addressed it, I'd be happy, but yeah. If he doesn't, I will.
That's exactly what it means.
Yeah.
Because not only does it restrict signage in the windows on the second floor, it restricts signage in the windows on the 22nd floor.
So
it's be out of context and out of character for the idea of allowing signs and would refute the findings and conclusions in the beginning of the document. So on the ground level, it's generally a sign that's either a pedestrian scale or at least a vehicular scale, somebody near the building.
Okay, so in a building like, you know, next, we age ourselves if you talk about things that aren't there anymore, but in the buildings that are next to where the Home Depot used to be, the Home Depot Expo used to be, where Best Buy is, you know, there's a second floor of stores there. Rooms to go soon, right? But
you're talking about where the Marshalls and the Best Buy.
Yeah, right. The Marshalls and the Best Buy. Those second floor stores would not be allowed to have any window signs, but the guys on the first floor would.
You're correct.
Okay.
Yeah, but
yeah, Bill.
This is what the PCID is all about.
Okay, and we can address that with the PCID overlay district when we get to the airport.
So are you only addressing items in the PCID?
Well, it's just a point that Jerry brought up. It's okay to do this, we just have to think about it.
I'm like Howard. You can only address the first floor, you got to let out all of it, but then you turn around and make a sign so small or restricted.
Yeah.
Second story up, it doesn't help anyway. The intent is to allow people on the first floor to advertise as people walk by.
Yep.
Not to allow somebody several stories up to advertise big enough to look up and see it.
Just raising the issue. I'm okay with the way it's written. Nobody else can.
I'm okay. All right. Did you see anything else on that, Jerry? I know I'd gotten some feedback from Bill on each of you.
And I think that the only other one that I thought felt like we might want to address was in the overlay district. So
I'm sorry, in the overlay.
So the only other one of Jerry Penn's that I thought we might want to discuss is in the overlay district. Right. So I'll hold off on that.
If you would.
Yeah.
Would you hold off?
Bill, you want
to? Right. Mm-hmm. On the main sign ordinance, not PCID, it restricts the use of internally lit signs. And quite honestly, that's very unrealistic. But I would say if the commercial buildings that are outside the village, that are outside of PCID, probably 30-40% of them have internally lit signs. I think that ought to be allowed. I'm speaking as a chance. No problem with restriction in the overlay district.
We're not talking about the overlay district yet.
No, I'm saying.
Right.
But
go ahead,
is
Bill. Other Bill.
I was going to say, everybody's through their questions. I've got three paper clips.
Okay. I think we're done on a regular. Before we go on to overlay, so go ahead.
No, this is sound ordinance.
Yeah, go ahead.
If you go, my first paper clip has to do with prohibited signs. Page number's there, so it's 14 on the one I've got. Anyway, it's...
I think we're probably going to get...
Has to do with portable signs.
What section or number?
Section 3, Article 3?
Yeah, that's right. It's in Section 3. Article 3, Section...
Section 3.
Article 3, Section 3.
Yep.
15. Portable signs.
Page 12, I think, on...
Page 13.
Page 13?
Yeah.
Thirteen on one, 12 on ours, and 15 on...
Portable signs.
As my choir director would say, page 4, 6 for somebody. Portable signs, we have an exception that we would like to add, and that is if it's not on yours. Vehicles painted with a business logo, name, or advertisement and used in normal day-to-day operations may be parked in the business parking lot. However, said vehicle shall be parked in a designated parking space and furthest from the right-of-way at the location of the business. And the purpose of this is to... People, what they're doing is they're getting an extra ground sign by painting on their vehicle and parking by the street.
Okay, so...
In fact, it was in an earlier version.
Beg your pardon?
It was in an earlier version.
It was, but it's one of those that just got overlooked.
Okay. Pulled off movers that parked outside.
Well, and there's also a politician that I won't name who drives a fire truck around and parks it up by the side of the road.
That's a little bit early.
Yeah, anyway. My second paper clip is
so Bill, on these suggestions you will funnel these up.
Mm-hmm. To, if he doesn't have them, I'll give them to him.
My only
comment I had was that you mentioned is there business vehicles?
I didn't say business vehicles, I said vehicles painted with the business logo, name, or advertisement and used in normal day-to-day operations are allowed to park in the parking lot. However, they got to go to the rear of the parking lot.
Okay.
If
you can look at it and see content, I have a very big question and a problem with it. Because in order to see that prohibition, you have to look and see that it's a logo. How do you define the logo? You know,
He
said logo for a business.
I said a logo. In fact, I said several things.
You have to read it to discern that it's a logo, which is where the problem is.
Or an advertisement.
But
I understand that.
Logo.
That's my problem. Is also, if I have a car, I can put a logo from a non-business or not? Because if you say no, then that means you have to read my car to decide whether it's a logo from a non-business.
Is there a suggestion, money?
I said it's a suggestion. Since there's a suggestion, I'm giving what the legal interpretation is, and you'll make the ultimate decision.
I understand that, but do you have a solution?
Do I have a solution?
As far as a wording that might...
I'm not sure there is one. You either allow everyone to have it on their cars or nobody.
I got it. Okay.
And that's where the problem comes in.
Okay.
Take the word business out. Vehicles painted with a logo XXXX.
There you go. I think the only thing that I have money that I thought you'd jump on is, you know, park furthest from the road and in a designated parking spot.
Actually, I don't have a problem with that. Because
yep.
that's time, place, and manner regulation.
Maybe the way to do that is just to say vehicles with signs attached to them.
I don't care how you word it, as long as you get it in.
No,
you're
going to have something that
attached.
Like,
attached.
You can't use it on signs on it. I mean, as long as it's on
sign. So you would allow moving signs on a vehicle, period. You would accept portable sign, from the definition of a prohibited portable sign, anything painted on a vehicle or put on a vehicle or taped to a vehicle. That's standing in any location. I just want to get that through as what you're saying that would be. And if you all want to do that, that's fine, but that's a policy. As long as you don't limit it to a certain group versus another group, I have no legal problem with it. That's
okay. All right. Bill? Bill?
Let me finish. I got one more.
I hope it's like that one.
Hope it's easier than that. This ought to be non-controversial. And flags, there's one sentence that needs to be changed. It's currently says the maximum dimensions of any flag shall be proportional to the flagpole height. The hoist side of the flag shall not exceed 20% of the vertical height of the flagpole. That is intended for ground-mounted flags. It doesn't say so. I just want to say that the flagpole when ground-mounted.
What page on?
I'm on
just a section.
My page 23. I don't know what yours is.
Page 21.
Okay. That's to do with flags.
What page you on, no one?
Oh, wait, B.
It would be 22 for one, 21 for us.
Bill, I'm on the same page. I think
it's 21.
Did you think it's last paragraph?
Yeah, it's
not in there.
B2.
Okay. He says it's in there. My point is that the copy I have doesn't say that the flagpole has to be ground mounted.
It's worried about the flags that are mounted on the fourth single.
Ground mounted.
Yeah.
Ground mounted.
Okay, I stand corrected.
It doesn't have to be this long just to put
it in
place.
That's the only mistake I made tonight. I'm in good shape. Phil Grant wants to talk about that.
All right, very briefly. It's interesting that the one comment I got from Chamber members was the subject of the signs on vehicles. And I got it from a half a dozen of them. But every one of them are people who are got a rolling billboard. Every one of them park at the edge, and they've been talked to by the city. Notwithstanding the comments about the logo, I think that this is a good thing in here. I'm speaking as the chairman of the chamber, but I'm also going against some of the members because those people are trying to get free signs. And put them in the back of the parking lot solves that problem, will go away.
Yeah, I'm definitely in favor of its wording.
Yeah, the challenge is to word it in a way that accomplishes the task, right?
So we'll leave that to the legal eagles.
I mean, it's probably the vehicles we're trying to get rid of just parked in non-designated spaces, or sometimes they park in perfectly legal parking spaces.
Perfectly legal
but very obvious places.
The issue is that we're trying to regulate signs, and you get around that by having a big sign on your vehicle. And so,
could you just change the definition of signs to include things on a corner when not moving, parked in a certain place, so that there's, you know,
to get rid of that as a sign?
Yeah, just basically call it a sign.
To make it a sign.
Add it to the definition.
Okay, and we'll
so then it would fall under the...
Then they need to regulate the place.
you could permit. That's fine. You could, but is that excluded from the definition of a sign currently? I thought it was a sign. It's currently part of the definition of a
sign right now. It's manifestly designed to be transported. It's a portable sign right now. They're unlawful right now.
Okay.
But you're trying to make them lawful.
They're
saying they're unlawful right now.
Okay, if they're unlawful right now, this may be a conversation we don't need to be having.
I just want to move them off the room. That's all I'm trying to do.
They're saying they're not legal.
They're unlawful, so technically they shouldn't be on the road. If they're in the back of the parking lot, not visible from the right of way, we don't regulate it anyway.
Yeah, but the definition reads, signs attached to or painted on vehicles parked and or stored while visible from the public right of way.
So if they're in the back of the parking lot,
portable signs.
The solution to this might be, I think we understand the intent of council is to allow these signs, but not have them parked in obvious places that are right on the right of way so that they can function as a billboard. Right. So that company, let my staff work out the language. We'll work out some language that will satisfy that somehow, some way.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
All right, anything else on sign? All right, overlay. And Denny, let's start. We're on
overlay.
Okay.
I only got about three items, actually. Page one on the overlay, as soon as they get back down there. Stage one, F and G. I thought that was somewhere along the line. I thought that was awful large signs, an 8-foot by 8-foot sign. I noticed one time it was 6-foot by 8-foot, and then lower down there, but greater than 9, I think it jumps up to 12-foot by 8-foot. you know, a 12-foot sign is a pretty darn big sign. And I think that's one of the things we got down in Georgetown right now. It's not even 12 feet, and we don't like that. So I think, I just thought that that was awful large for those signs, especially in the overlay district. You have a, you know, put a sign up 8 feet by 8 feet. That's a pretty big, that's a double piece of drywall, 4x8 double shot. And the other one is a triple shot. So 12 feet high is awful high for a sign, I thought, in the overlay district. And that's item G down there. More than 10 or more storefronts shall not exceed 12 feet in height and 8 feet in width. And then up there in item F, with 9 or fewer, it's 8 feet by 8 feet. That's a pretty big sign to be hanging out there.
We did increase those numbers, but if you don't have one sign for the lot and trying to get them, remember, 9 storefronts could be a lot more than 9 businesses. If they all wanted to advertise, you couldn't get very many names on it. It's not as big. It is a big sign, but it's not big when you start putting a lot of names on it. So if we're going to restrict them to one sign of, let's say, a subdivision, a parking,
a curb cut or frontage.
If you're going to do that, we felt like you needed to give them enough space to put the names on that if everybody advertises. I'm not
going to
argue over
10
versus 12, but
I'm
just
saying. A 12-foot sign, a 12-foot high sign is just a big sign. I mean, that's more than a story high. And I just consider that to be, you know, you're driving down the street and here we are trying to restrict some of this. And one of the signs we've talked about several times is the one down in Georgetown. And that's a problem. There's a certain council member that sits right here. It's not here tonight. You know, she jumps on that. But I just think that that's, I think it's too big. That's just me talking. That's just me. My goals would not to be ever that big. Either one of them.
You've got 12 businesses, and they've got 12 foot as a maximum amount of height of the sign. That means that each sign is going to be only a foot high. Quite frankly, that's probably not very high for a sign to try to get association with businesses.
Well, even if they put them side by side, they're still going to be unrecognizable if you're driving down the road.
But you may have one business in there
exactly
that has a 12-foot high sign.
Well, I mean, you can't restrict the sign based on how many people advertise on it, because if it's a
If it's got 10 or more storefronts,
theoretically everybody in there could advertise on this. And you can't say if only 6 advertise, because you don't know how many are going to advertise and how many not.
How about if we redefine the idea of storefronts instead of storefronts to businesses or I don't know. Just come up with a term. Storefronts is just a hollow term. And I thought storefronts was a business. That's what I was using that as. That was an entity. Let's just call it an entity. 10 entities, if you will.
I mean, if you drive along where Bill's office is, you'll find about 15 or 20 signs along the street there. And as I understand what we're doing here, we're going to take that and restricted to like 3 or 4 signs, because there's 3 or 4 curb cuts in there.
That's correct.
And so it's going to clean that up so that Bill won't have an individual sign, and the gear doctor next to him won't have a sign, and the foot doctor down the street won't have their individual signs. They'll all be posted in an appropriate manner on a 12-foot by 8-foot sign, whatever this dimension is.
Yes, Bill was going to talk about this, but we have killed the idea of 6 foot 6x6 posts and going straight to ground signs. So it would be one sign per lot.
Right. I mean, I'm thinking about the Walgreens monument sign that's on Mount Vernon. It's got done with prep, and it's got, you know, it's got Walgreens at the top. It's, you know, it's advertising, I don't know, 2 dozen businesses. And if the maximum height of that is 12 feet, that seems reasonable to me. That's their only sign on Mount Vernon.
I think my son-in-law's practice on Mount Vernon, 7 and 30 Mount Vernon.
it has about six businesses on there, and it, that sign's probably 10 or 12 feet tall there.
The one that's Studwood Village on Mount Vernon, that was put up before, and therefore it is grandfathered. But it's a lot taller than 12 feet. So don't use that as an example. But I mean, even that one, though, is, if you look at it, it's full.
It is full.
Okay, well, that's everybody's got an opinion on that. Bill, you just brought up a point in chapter 27, and I, apparently it is. I didn't read it in here. Is anything grandfathered?
Well, that's true of most any law.
Not necessarily. Is it so? Anything that's prior to this?
I will ask Howard to help me on this, but I think it's anything that was legal at the time it was erected, if it's a sign. Therefore, as long as it stays, it's grandfathered. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. As long as it was legal before we came into being, or before this sign ordinance came into being, or the amendment came into being, it's there until it's gone.
With the proper permit.
As long as it's legally permitted by whatever jurisdiction permitted.
Now, if it was not legal, although erected before the city done one, under the code at that time, under that jurisdiction, then it's not correct.
As well, they could have been issued an erroneous permit. Let's get back.
Well, yes. If they were issued an erroneous permit that wasn't legal for the district according to the ordinance, yes. But if they were issued erroneously a permit because the application had something in there, if it was a procedural error but not a substantive error, it would be grandfathered.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, so basically, if it was legal on 1 December 2008 and permitted, it's grandfathered. Is that what I can say?
If it was legal right now and then becomes illegal when this ordinance, when this new amendment comes into being in a month, it will be grandfathered to this new ordinance. So it's whenever, as long as it was legally permitted, it stays until it's gone.
So it's 1 December or when this is approved. Okay. The last thing, do signs like open signs and window, and windows of businesses, are they included in internal signs of windows and, the business just says open on it. It's lit. It's in a window. In chapter, on page 2, here in this, chapter 27.
You're still talking about the overlay district?
Yes, I am. Yeah, I'm only talking about the overlay district now.
So that last item on that first page is window signs larger than 2 feet by 2 square feet are prohibited. The idea is that window signs smaller than 2 feet by 2 feet are okay, and that's your open close sign.
Okay, but the sign is lit?
Not in the overlay district. Yeah.
Okay.
Some are, but that's...
Was that ever legal? Because I know several businesses
that. No, it was not.
None of that beyond.
Okay. What about any lit signs that are inside the business that are not visible from the street?
If it's not visible from the right of way, we do not regulate it.
Okay. That's all.
Hi, Dave. What's the definition of traditional?
Are we going to require that all signs have to be compatible with a pre-1900?
No, it's not in sign. What he's talking about is plate page lit.
I'm talking, well, it says...
Where's the reference?
The sign, number B. Page 1. Sign shall be designed to be sold to be compatible with village/traditional style that is characteristic of Dunwoody Village overlay.
And originally we had in here drawings of what it could be.
And then we've gotten rid of it. But, there are traditional shapes and there are non-traditional, the modern shapes.
So traditional is, if I went up to somebody like you and I said, your sign has to be traditional, you'd say, roger that, and go on going.
I would understand.
We just need to make sure we're defining that, Gary.
carefully to the ordinance, because you can't be
arbitrary. Yes, but that needs a different word. Whatever word you use has to be defined in the
contract. It's got to be defined very carefully. You can't have opinions.
Add that warrant.
What?
For y'all, we need to find a definition. If it's traditional, not the proper word, let's come up with one and then define it.
Right, it needs to be something we can do.
Go look at Hilton Head. How does Hilton Head deal with it? Or how do they come up with 10 different communities? I guarantee you pull their codes. They have fought this battle before, and we're not reinventing something brand new here.
I think the issue really is that in the ordinance, it's not normally the place you talk about design. The kind of issues, you reference a design that would be in your adopted design guidelines. So that it's just an awkward fit for the ordinance. But if it's very specifically defined, where the overlay ordinance has to be black and white. You either meet it or you don't. And that's what we just got to make sure that if we're going to use that, you need to be able to define it where anybody can come up and just say yes.
All right, we'll see if there's, there's a word.
I think there's, just like colonial is an architectural style, I believe, without being an architect, I've heard traditional being an architectural style. So.
The problem that when you get into is that you can define it as an architectural style, but it's up to the person reviewing it to determine whether or not it's compatible with it. That's my problem, is compatible really lends to arbitrary decision can be made by, because you've got humans making the decision to decide whether it's compatible, and it's not a black or white. Normally you would do those in a design guideline for a certificate of appropriateness is when you would go into issues of opinion of whether or not it's compatible.
You said traditional, and you said as specified in the design guideline.
But we don't have design guidelines.
Right,
that's the issue. After the master plan, I must suggest we move forward with that, but we're not there yet.
Okay, let me take executive privilege, call Hayward. I know a couple of you are dying to speak, but let me call you up as an expert in the sign business, just to...
It's a discrepancy, I see, and I could be wrong, but
this is gonna
in the overlay district, you have a 2 square feet window sign. Am I shifting gears here? Is this wrong? But,
we're talking on
traditional. Yeah. I don't know if I can really define that. I think you're okay. Right.
Well, we'll have public comment again where you come up and talk.
Yeah, I was going about the windows.
Okay. I know it's tough.
That's okay.
All right.
So we're Bill?
Yeah.
Okay. Two last points. I think this thing about this, the number of signs is a loaded thing. I said entrances to an area. Howard said lots. Well, in my case, there's one lot, 9 buildings. So I don't think lot is the right thing. I think it's got to be entrances or something like that. Okay. The second thing is, and it was in here, and I don't know who took it out. We went to some length to say the businesses in the overlay district can have signs on more than one side, maximum 2, of their building. If they face on all the sides, either large parking lots or the street. These are convenience to the business, but they're very much a convenience to the pedestrian or to the people driving around. If somebody took it out, it needs to go back in.
Is that,
it's a good point.
I'm seeing the red lines here.
Yeah, right. We talked about that at the community council, and before the recommendations went to the planning commission, we took that out because that allows more wall signs for certain businesses in the overlay district that are not allowable citywide, so you're creating a lax standard instead of a more strict standard.
Are you saying citywide, are you only allowed to have one face?
Yes.
No, that ought to get changed.
We changed something on that because we just talked about that over somewhere in the PCIT, we changed that.
Tall stories and higher and someone?
Yeah.
Where you could divide up
the kind of wall signs. Like the AJC or something.
Yeah. AJC, y'all didn't do that. Y'all didn't want to make that change for AJC.
We're zoning change for that. They were ZBA.
Just for 12 stories and higher is the only exception.
That one.
Is that correct, Howard?
I think Bill's got a point there. I think, if it's got more than...
then we need to make that change citywide. If you want it to happen there, it needs to happen.
I agree that it ought to be made citywide. I didn't realize it was not available.
Hey, Bill,
if you do it
citywide, and you say if the two sides are facing either street or primary parking lot, then you don't just have it stuck out. Although, practically, they want to go put it where it can be seen by the public. But I think you should allow somebody to put a sign up throughout the city, two signs if they have a sidewalk.
If they face two.
If they have a secondary facade, isn't that the word we use?
Used to.
Okay. I'm good with that.
Then what about the aggregate square footage? Do corner buildings get double the square footage, or each sign is half the size?
If they want to, they got each side's got to be half the size.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Is that going to impact the exception when it's a 12-story building?
I'm going to look at all the consequences of that. I think it will have a lot.
It's also a difference when you've got a one-story building, a 15-story building, have the sign as big and you get.
But we've already made an exception. We've already got language that allows.
I want to make sure this is going to conflict with that. That's why I just want to make sure it doesn't conflict.
Right, well, so let's just make this for buildings that are under 12 stories. And you've got what? The standard we've already talked about. Buildings that are over 12, we've got a different standard between the other 12.
I think if we meet this traditional business, what are we doing there?
Their staff's going to go back and come up with there's not an answer right now.
Yeah, I cannot give an answer tonight because that'll have some farther reaching implications than to just say it now. I'd like to evaluate the other problem.
Yep.
It'll happen before the second.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else, Ed? No, I was on David.
You two here?
Bill. Robert?
Ed.
Bill? Do you have any more comments? Bill 1, not Bill 2. Because I think Bill 2 does that.
Way past Bill 2's bedtime.
He's grumpy. All right. All right, that's disappointing all of them. We're going to move on to discussion of special call election. And really quickly recap, we know Councilman Taylor, due to some state laws, I think, might need to resign his seat.
By operation of the Georgia Constitution, he has already vacated it. He needs to do nothing else.
He's already vacated.
Well, this is maybe.
No.
Opinion of the Assistant City Attorney is that the Georgia Constitution has vacated his seat.
Got it.
Mr. Taylor is,
yes,
is exploring other legal opinions,
right,
and has not yet accepted that opinion of the Assistant City Attorney.
Okay.
Doesn't make his conclusion any less valid. It's just we haven't resolved this yet.
Okay. Thank you for starting us off that way. So nevertheless, we got some options here. Talking with Sharon on a special election, and Sharon has set up for us the three, really what I see is two options, but there are three options. There's a July option, a September option, and then a November option. So Sharon, you want to come in?
Yes, sir, that is correct. For special election, July 20th. July 20th, in conjunction with the general primary, September, and then again in November with the general election. I'll prepare a timeline for you to consider tonight for the July special election to be held in conjunction with the general primary. There's a number of deadlines and procedures that I'd have to meet. I believe we can do those. It would be tight, a little challenging, but depending on what you all, your wishes are, we could start on that process tomorrow. When you're having an election, a special election in conjunction with a general primary, you have to call the election within 60 days of that election. And of course, DeKalb County would be conducting our election. So the call is actually the advertisement that goes in the paper that notifies the public that we're having a special election, the date of that special election. We'll also have to publish a qualifying fee, which we can do in conjunction with that one advertisement, what the district seat is that's vacant.
Does the
does the council need to set the qualifying fees at a special call meeting?
No, sir. It's actually already set by ordinance. In our ordinance, it's 3% of the gross salary of that particular seat.
It's actually, I think it's more than that now. All right, so Danny, question.
I don't believe I was that, and I'm assuming that Mr. Taylor has to resign. But my comments are only if he has to resign, and I'm not concluding that he may not have to resign. I think that if he has to resign, we need to fill the seat as quickly as possible. And I would think it would be more time to do it come the 20th of July and meet this timeline. I know it's going to be tight. We need to advertise and get it out there so people will be able to qualify for it. But this is certainly, we're here tonight with four people. One of us can't go to the bathroom without stopping the entire meeting. So
do you need to use your restroom? My only issue with this is we got 14 days for John Q. Public, anybody out there, to make a decision, if I'm reading this right, for qualification to be May 10th. So really, in reality, someone would already have to be queued up and ready to go, which I'm not comfortable with. For the average person to make a decision and to even know this is happening, I'm not confident that's going to trickle down in time and to make a decision in the qualifying time. Again, that's right. I don't know of anybody that's queued up,
I don't know if there's anybody queued up either. It's obviously it's coming up pretty quick, but I think that you're not giving the Dunwoody citizens credit enough to be able to see the situation and make a decision about what to do. I agree with Danny. I think that we do the city a disservice by not having seven people up here, and I think we're best served by doing it in July. I also think that the turnout will be better in July than it will be in September, which is the next possible date. I worry about doing a special called election on a date where that's the only thing on the ballot.
That's out of question.
I think, right, and it's very expensive. So either we got to do it in July or we got to spend 6 months without somebody, an extra person. So I'm willing to ask staff to push hard to make this happen.
Okay, let me ask you, Sharon. I'm definitely not comfortable moving formally forward without Councilman Hennigan or Councilwoman Bonder being part of this process. And again, I know with our legal team's status on this, but until Councilman Taylor, we hear back to make sure. Again, I'm not comfortable throwing that item as a completely done deal. But having said all that, for you to move forward, if we had to step back, go ahead. Is there any negatives to that? See what I'm saying? If we say, okay, well, stop, something has changed. Tom has not actually have to quit. What is that? Where are we losing money somewhere?
Y'all understand what I'm asking?
It's the call of the election. Because our legal organ is published once a week, so we would hit a May 5th publication date. You cannot have your qualifying until after that call is published.
That means you got tomorrow.
So that the people that are here would understand is Tom's intention when he sought this position was that he would be able to remain in office. And he's only trying to get a clarity on that because his intentions were to, after the primary election, to resign at that point, assuming that he was the winner of the primary. And that would give us sufficient time at that time to be able to put it on the November ballot. But we would not be without somebody for that long period of time from now until November. I hate that we have to push this, and I know Tom is really working diligently to find out and get resolved in his own mind with outside counsel if he has to resign. And then once that's determined, I think we need to move as swiftly as we can.
Mr. Mayor, to better answer your question, there is no downside. If staff were to move ahead with the call for the election, which doesn't require council approval, Sharon would take the first initial steps. If Tom turns out that he is valid, then we would void the election. It'd be impossible for you to have a special election.
Yeah, understood. Okay, good.
It was not vacated.
All right, that answers that.
Yes. When is the last date that we can get somebody's name? We can get names on the ballot for July 20th.
So the qualifying period is from that we're suggesting is an abbreviated one. That's 2.5 days from May 10th to the 12th. So after the 12th qualifying ends, no more names can go on the ballot at that point.
Correct.
Isn't there a write-in period after qualification dates?
And that is, let me clarify that in the memo, and City Manager brought this up tonight when I showed him the memo. That write-in period, those names don't go on the ballot, actually, and it's up to whoever those candidates are to publish an ad in the legal organ, letting people know that they're going to be a write-in candidate. Then you'd read that ad if you were a voter, and you might write that person's name in on the ballot.
The way that works is that if I go to the ballot the day of the election and I decide that I'm going to just vote for my wife because I just feel like doing that, that vote doesn't count. I can only vote for the folks that have legally registered as write-in candidates. They won't appear on the ballot, but they're the only other people you can vote for by write-in ballot than the candidates that are already on the ballot, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
Okay.
So it's irrelevant to your process on the write-in ballot. It doesn't slow us down.
Well, any other thoughts?
Yeah, please. And we do not have to vote on this as a council.
Technically, no.
Superintendent calls the election. Chair,
as a
superintendent.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to clarify, not clarify, but point out one other thing. If you notice on this timeline, there's pre-clearance by the Department of Justice. We'll go ahead and start that process regardless of the outcome of Mr. Taylor's research that he's doing right now.
If we have a conflict of opinion, outside counsel says no, then inside counsel says yes. How do you determine at that point, how to proceed?
I'll take a shot at this one.
Okay.
There's a couple of things that can occur. One is that if someone challenged Tom sitting on the council at a later date, the court would then make the determination whether or not he was sitting legally or not. If he was sitting illegally, then any of his votes would be invalidated, and if it was a 4-3 vote, it would invalidate whatever action the council's taken. That's the downside risk. The other methodology is that somebody, an interested party, could file a writ of ouster to force the issue into a court, and then the court would then decide whether or not he was legally seated or not. So there's no action the council has to take. The attorney's opinion is just that. Although I don't disagree with Lenny's opinion, it's just an opinion. It doesn't force any action. If Tom decided to resign, that would vacate the seat, and then the special election would kick in. Or if he was ousted, then it would also kick in.
All right. Well, I don't think he's going to do anything.
He will not. Let me just ask you a question. If you go to the state attorney general's office and say, we need an opinion, it seems to me like that opinion should hold some water. That should be the place where we would go to get an opinion of such things.
You won't get it back in time. You're not going to get it back in time. First of all, there's two types of opinions, and correct me when I go wrong here, is you've got a formal and an informal opinion. An informal opinion can be requested by a member of the legislature, and I think a formal opinion has to come from the governor. Is that correct?
I believe, yes. I mean, you can request someone in the office of the...
You can request an opinion of the AG. An opinion from the Secretary of State, from the AG's office.
Is there such a thing as an expedited request?
You can make an expedited request?
Will give us and I believe they've already given us.
They have. I actually spoke to the Secretary of State's office yesterday, again today, on various issues. And they cite the Constitution, the state of Georgia Constitution, that it's not at the end of the qualifying period. It's when a candidate goes down Actually, signs, take the oath, and signs are qualifying for them. The Constitution clearly states that you have vacated your seat at that point.
Okay. Well, can we get that in? Can we get that kind of reference, that portion of the Constitution?
Yes.
Absolutely.
I can.
And one other thing I will tell you that the Secretary of State does is they will always refer a superintendent like myself back to the city attorney. They just do that. You know, you need to consult with your city attorney. But they did cite the Constitution, and they did read it off to me, and I also had it before me.
Okay. All right. Well, let's y'all do your thing.
Okay.
You'll need anything from us.
Well, okay. We certainly didn't want to call an election without getting the council's
on. Yeah,
you know,
you're smart.
I'll ask Sharon.
I've got this whole survival instinct.
I'll also ask Sharon, with council permission, to contact both John and Adrian tomorrow and just at least get their input into it.
Yep. Yeah, that would be.
Obviously, okay. If they agree, then y'all can bring that back up.
To answer the councilman's question, it would be Article 2, Section 2, Paragraph 5 of the Georgia Constitution.
Can you email that to the council?
Yes.
I don't think I've got Georgia Constitution on my bedside.
On your
I may.
You should. There's a make total.
All right. So we're moving it on. Text amendments, we do not have any. We're not going to wait for executive session. Is there any public comment cards? If so, we can bring them forward. Yeah, come on up.
I got it.
Yeah, and just state your name in the microphone and your address so we get it on record, please.
Real simple. My name's Hayward Westcott. I own a sign company. I live in Dunway, Georgia.
Thank you.
In the overlay district, under window signs, going back to the sign ordinance, it says that window signs for no larger than 2 square feet are prohibited. Then you go to the regular sign ordinance. It says door signs not to exceed 1 square foot. It just seems like you have a smaller sign outside the overlay district on the window. That's all.
So that's it. You just referenced it. That door signs?
Door
signs.
It is a...
Door signs.
Window signs. It's under Article 3... Item number, under Article 3, Section 1, Item number 2, door signs not to exceed 1 square foot in size, no more than one per side door.
I think they were somewhere writing there.
So I was just saying, this is, they're contradicting each other, that's all.
That's all I got.
Just trying to
thank you for it. All right, anybody else for public comment? All right. We're going to adjourn. Thank you. I'll second. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say aye. We are done.
I want to read you 27 more pages.
I don't know if somebody here today.
Can I explain later?